Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm talking with Richard A. Billows about his study of the legend and legacy of Alexander the Great, entitled Before and After Alexander. Richard, welcome to the show.
Hello.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Well, I'm originally from England, but have been living in the United States since 1980. I've been a professor of Greek and Roman history at Columbia University since 1985, I teach a variety of courses there. I like to study a variety of different subjects having to do with the ancient Greeks and Romans, but certainly one of the subjects that I've worked on a lot is what we call the Hellenistic world, which is the phase of ancient Greek civilization in which they spread out to cover the entire Eastern Mediterranean and Western Asia from roughly modern-day Afghanistan to the Mediterranean and down to into North Africa, Egypt and Libya, in this vast kind of sphere of civilization. And of course, that expansion of the Greek world is associated in the popular memory above all with the name of Alexander the Great, hence the title of my book.
What was it that led you to write this book about his reputation and his legacy in particular?
I've been reading a great deal about Alexander for nearly 40 years, he has an immense reputation as this pivotal, seminal figure. And the more I read about him, the more it seemed to me that his reputation was greatly exaggerated. I wanted to get at the question of how was it possible for this young man who was 20 at the time when he began his career of conquests to undertake this this extraordinary campaign all the way across Western Asia and North Africa that he did. Where did his army come from? How was he able to engage in these fantastic marches and battles? That led me to look in detail at the development of his home country, Macedonia, in northern Greece, and how the Macedonians came to be a sufficiently strong power to undertake this campaign of conquest. In addition, when I was a graduate student, I became interested in the phase in which this vast area that had quickly been conquered by Alexander was turned into a series of functioning empires under the so-called successors of Alexander. And I was aware of how much work they had to put into transforming a simple act of conquest into an ongoing system of states with a defined civilization and culture. So it just seemed to me that that story of how the Macedonians came to be capable of doing what they did under Alexander's leadership, and how the really hard work of turning a brief act of conquest into a functioning state system and civilization should be brought out much more strongly, showing that Alexander was really a pivoting point rather than this extraordinary creative figure that he's often presented as being.
One of the things you do in your book is you show also how the two are connected, how the shape of the Alexandrian legacy is determined by that base that he inherits. So I want to take us back a bit to the base that you describe. And one of the things that you do is you don't just start with Alexander's father, Philip. You actually go back and describe a bit about the kingdom that emerged prior to their reigns. So what was Macedonia like, and what were the assets that led both Philip and then Alexander to achieve all that they did?
Well, this is the really interesting and fascinating part of the story to me, is that Macedonia, before the time of Alexander's father, Philip II, played only a very minor and peripheral role in ancient Greek history. During the great period of what we call classical Greek civilization, when Greeks were dominated by the great city-states of Athens and Sparta, Macedonia was an unimportant and largely unregarded backwater in terms of the sort of the power politics of the era. And yet that disguised the fact that Macedonia actually had a fairly significant role, because city-states like Athens and Sparta needed a variety of natural resources in order to be able to do what they did. They needed metals, they needed timber, they needed grain to feed their populations. And Macedonia was really the only region in the Greek world, per se, that produced large quantities of timber and of various metals for export. The Greeks were able to import timber and metals from elsewhere outside the Greek world proper, but Macedonia was within Greece and had surpluses of these products that were crucial, especially to Athens. And what that meant was that the more advanced city-states of southern Greece constantly interfered in Macedonia, and by their interference helped to keep Macedonia weak, because a weak Macedonia was easy for them to exploit. So it was really interesting to see that this region of Greece that, in terms of its natural resources, had great potential, failed to develop that potential into any kind of actual power or significant role other than as a source of natural resources in the Greek history of that time. And of course, that then highlights the work that Philip II did in transforming a place that had had no significant power or impact before his time into the dominant state and power in the Greek world.
One of the things you do in those early chapters is not just describe Macedonia, but you also highlight that contrast. It's not just that Macedonia is this great base of resources, but also how the contrast with the Greek city-states, which are oftentimes very much on the borderline of survival in terms of their climate, their condition. And it really conveys the sense that Macedonia, as you've already alluded to, was something of a sleeping force in terms of the politics of the region.
It was a sleeping force. It had the manpower resources, it had timber, it had abundant food supply compared to the rest of Greece at that time. Most of the Greek cities had to import substantial quantities of food. Macedonia seems to have been not only largely self-sustaining, but actually a net exporter of food. It had the metals, which were very scarce elsewhere in Greece. What it lacked, of course, was organization, and that's really the key. But the interesting thing about the Greek city-states is the way that places that, in terms of resources, were undoubtedly very poor, by their organization fulfilled their human potential in extraordinary ways. The city-state culture with collective systems of political decision-making, collective systems of security and defense, and attack for that matter in warfare, a Greek city-state was able to mobilize an extraordinary percentage of its manpower for war when necessary. You know, a modern state like America, for example, when America is at war, we don't really mobilize more than a couple of percent of our potential manpower to go and fight. When Athens was at war, it was not unusual for it to mobilize as much as 50% of its manpower to go and fight. And that's an extraordinary ability that these city-states had. Macedonia, because of the nature of its organization as a land dominated by a traditional landowning aristocracy who fought on horseback, was more in line with modern types of states in that for warfare it mobilized only a small percentage of its manpower. And in order for Macedonia to be able to compete in the international power politics of that time, it had to find a way to be able to mobilize much more than that small percentage, and that's what Philip II found a way to do.
Given the role that Philip II plays, I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit upon who he was and what it was that led him to undertake this effort to mobilize Macedonia. And having mobilized Macedonia, what does he then do with this developed strength that he has created?
Philip came from the ruling family of the Macedonian realm. It's a kind of a tribal kingdom. With a family with sort of multiple branches competing for rule over the region. His father came from a branch of the ruling family that had not played a major role in the previous two generations, but he succeeded in making himself the ruler, and with various ups and downs, he was almost kicked out a couple of times, managed to cling on to the position of ruler for nearly 20 years and pass it on to his sons. Philip was the third son and clearly could not have expected ever to be the ruler himself, since he had two older brothers who came before him. It so happened that his two older brothers both died very young, violently, as many early Macedonian rulers did. And Philip unexpectedly found himself in the position of being able and needed to take over as ruler when he was about 24 years old, in the wake of a terrible military disaster. His second brother, named Perdiccas, had gone to war against a neighboring non-Greek people called the Illyrians, and not only managed to get defeated, but the defeat was, it basically destroyed the Macedonian army, such as it was at that time. With the result that something like a quarter of Macedonia was occupied by these Illyrians from roughly modern-day Albania. And seeing an opportunity, other neighboring peoples invaded Macedonia from three other directions as well. And you had a situation in which Macedonia seemed to be on the verge of ceasing to exist as any kind of functioning community or state. It was apparently going to be taken over and ruled by neighboring peoples, divided up. And for whatever reasons, Philip had a remarkable personality, obviously. He decided that not only was he not going to accept that, he made it his task to prevent that from happening, but also then to go on and find a way to prevent that kind of a situation from ever occurring again. He saw, was able to see, that Macedonia had great resources and great potential, and he didn't want his homeland to be the weak plaything of stronger neighboring powers that it had been throughout his life, under his father and under his two older brothers. And his problem was to find a way in which to fully express the potential strength that Macedonia had. And it's often been suggested, and I think rightly, that a crucial role was played here by the fact that when he was in his teens, Philip was sent as a hostage to the southern Greek city-state of Thebes for 3 years, at a time when the Thebans were revolutionizing Greek warfare and dominating most of Greece for a period of about 10 years. Thebes, a city-state that had always played a secondary role before, and seeing what these extraordinary Theban leaders were doing in changing the nature of warfare and turning a second-ranked power into the dominant power in the Greek world, I think had an impact on Philip in suggesting to him that the same kind of thing could be done with Macedonia, change the way in which we fight warfare so as to maximize the resources that Macedonia has, and thereby enable Macedonia to show strength rather than weakness.
How were the Thebans revolutionizing warfare, and how did Philip incorporate that into the Macedonian forces?
Greek warfare for 200 years had been pretty static. It was based on a collective system in which what we call citizen militia soldiers, that is to say, citizens acting in a military role at their own expense and as a matter of honor and pride and duty on behalf of their community. So a Greek soldier was just a citizen who equipped himself with military equipment, saw to learning a basic familiarity with the use of that equipment and the kind of military formation in which he would be expected to use it, maintained his own fitness, and that's why the Greeks developed this athletic gymnasium culture that they're famous for. And then, you know, whenever occasion called for it, thousands of these Greek citizen militia soldiers would march out together and literally take a stand on behalf of their community. And the style of warfare was basically very stereotyped. Thousands of men would simply arrange themselves with the help of their leaders into neat lines and files of men. The role of the general was to get the men organized properly into their formation that was called a phalanx. And then it was just up to the men themselves to stand their ground and try to push the enemy back. So it didn't require any outstanding leadership or any particular inventiveness or daring. It was a very collective system that relied on discipline. And the Spartans dominated this kind of warfare for a couple of hundred years, because whereas in other Greek city-states, the citizens you know, had regular lives. They were farmers, they were carpenters, they were smiths or fishermen or whatever, who took down their armor, you know, and put it on and went out to fight when the need arose. In Sparta, the Spartans had a peculiar socioeconomic system in which the Spartan citizens dedicated themselves 100% to being warriors and warriors alone, which made them much more expert at this kind of fighting than anyone else. And the problem that the Theban leaders had was how not to be beaten by these Spartans. And they had been beaten by not only Spartans, but Athenians too, many times in their history. This new generation of Theban leaders realized if we change the formation in which we fight, we can be more than a match for the Spartans. Instead of, if there are, say, 2,000 Spartans confronting them with 2,000 Thebans and hoping that we can outfight them, what happens if we confront 2,000 Spartans with 6,000 Thebans and attack them with some men on horseback from the side at the same time? It seems like a very simple idea, and I think it is a very simple idea. It's just that no one had had it for 200 years. And suddenly the Thebans defeated the Spartans, who were always regarded as invincible. By defeating the Spartans, suddenly the Thebans are the dominant military power in Greece, until everyone else realized it's just that they've rethought the formation. And we can do that too. But that gave, I think, to Philip the idea that, in the first place, you know, there's nothing set in stone about military strength or weakness. For 200 years, the Spartans were invincible, and then, you know, these Theban leaders had a new idea, and they showed that they're not invincible after all. So there's probably a way in which we Macedonians can stop being weak and easily beaten by everyone and become strong. It's just a matter of figuring out, you know, what advantages do the Macedonians have? How can we express strength? What do we need to do, you know, to present ourselves on the battlefield in a position where we can win the way that the Thebans did against the Spartans?
So Philip applies himself to this, and he organizes Macedonia. What does he then set out to accomplish, and how successful is he?
Extraordinarily successful. The key thing, what prevented the Macedonians from being successful in the kind of warfare that the southern Greeks had been fighting for 200 years was the lack of a well-to-do middle class. As I've mentioned, these citizen militia soldiers of southern Greece equipped themselves with their military equipment, and it was quite expensive. So these soldiers are all reasonably well-to-do middle-class men with farms and small businesses and so on, carpenters, smiths, I mentioned that, who could afford to purchase the armor and equipment that you needed to fight in this distinctive collective southern Greek style. And Macedonia, because it was a land dominated by large landowners and a subordinated class of peasants who worked as a kind of serfs or at best as tenants and sharecroppers on the lands owned by the rich, didn't have that kind of middle class. So Philip had to figure out a way in which he could mobilize thousands and thousands of soldiers, and there were plenty of men in Macedonia, but they could not equip themselves with the armor required to do the southern Greek style of fighting. So the problem was, what do we have that can substitute for that? And very smartly, he recognized that what Macedonia had in abundance was timber. And traditionally, extraction of timber in Macedonia was controlled by the ruler. The ruler determined who was allowed to extract timber and how much and on what terms, which meant that as ruler, Philip could get lots and lots of timber just for the sake of sending men out to cut it. And what he did was to develop a new kind of weapon, what in modern terms is called a pike. The ancient Greek term was sarissa, where southern Greeks wore a lot of body armor that protected them extremely well and used an 8-foot thrusting spear as their offensive weapon. Philip produced thousands of 16 to 20-foot pikes and equipped men with them, which he could do, because, as I said, as ruler, he had the right to cut timber. The advantage of a 16 to 20-foot pike is that you didn't need a lot of body armor because you stuck the head of your pike against the enemy's shield, and with his 8-foot spear, he couldn't reach you.
You have a great picture in your book, which illustrates just how much of an advantage that is. You have the Southern Greek hoplite reenactor with both the javelin and spear. And it's pretty clear that the Macedonian sarissa gives the warrior, he just has such an advantage in terms of being able to attack without worrying about being attacked in reverse, because the hoplites didn't use their spears as throwing spears. They used them as stabbing spears.
Right. Exactly. So he was able to, very quickly, recruit 10,000 men and equip them with these pikes. It's a weapon that requires a dense formation, because one man with one of these things, you could easily slip past the head of his pike and get at him personally from close range. And since he has virtually no body armor, he's very vulnerable. But if you've got 10,000 men equipped with these pikes, all in a dense formation, as long as they're drawn up in a place where it's not easy to get around the side of them or come at them from behind, if you have to come at them from in front, it's kind of like trying to pick up a porcupine. It's a bristling array of these pike heads sticking out at you, and you can't easily get at the soldiers holding the pikes. And with this formation, and with the Macedonian cavalry, the Macedonians had always been good with cavalry, because that was the expertise of these aristocrats who owned most of the land. The problem is that a few thousand cavalry are not very effective against 10 or 15,000 heavily armored men who stand their ground. Once you have a dense formation of pikemen to take on these men standing their ground, and they can't come at you from the side because the cavalry are protecting you there, now you suddenly have a military system that has a chance of standing up against the neighboring powers of Macedonia. And under Philip's leadership, in fact, they did more than stand up. They started to win. And over the course of a 24-year reign, they won spectacularly. Philip led his armies to victories throughout the southern Balkan Peninsula against people called the Thracians, who lived in modern-day Bulgaria and Romania, against Illyrians, who lived in modern-day Serbia and Albania, and, of course, against the southern Greeks. And the result is that when Philip died in 336, suddenly assassinated by a disgruntled officer in his bodyguard who had a personal grudge, he was only 47 at the time, Philip, that is. When Philip died, Macedonia either directly ruled or dominated pretty much the whole region from the great Danube River south, the Balkan Peninsula, from, as I've said, Serbia and Albania and Romania, Bulgaria, down to the Aegean Sea, all of Greece. It was that power block, that extraordinary army, with a two-decade-long history of unbroken success, and above all, a group of officers who had been trained by Philip over those 20 years how to command that army in battle. That is what Alexander inherited, and that's what enabled Alexander, seemingly out of nowhere, to go across and invade the Persian Empire and engage in all those conquests.
And that gets to the central focus of, or the central argument in your book, which is the degree to which Alexander's achievements are built not upon his, any sort of unique ability or success that he has, but that it's built upon this achievement of his father's, the army, the kingdom, the generals that are there to serve him. You detail, when you're describing Alexander, the degree to which so many of his achievements during his famed conquests are the result of the tactics employed and the army that he used. You also, and you bring it to this question, which I thought was very fascinating, of analyzing what exactly makes Alexander great.
Well, exactly. When you think of rulers through history who are called the great, they usually have a number of different kinds of achievements to their credit. They are reformers. They are organizers of their peoples and state systems. They create new legal codes. They bring changes to their societies in various ways and improvements. Alexander is called the Great for really one reason only, so far as one can see, and that is the pure act of conquest, because he didn't live long enough to do anything with those conquests beyond the sheer fact of conquering. And it's really not clear in what we know of him that he had any particular ideas of what to do with all these lands that he'd conquered. He seems to have enjoyed the sheer act of conquest for its own sake. And when we consider how he did that conquering, he inherited the best army in the ancient world, with an unbroken tradition of 20 years of outstanding success, fighting with a kind of weaponry and in a kind of system that had proved itself better than any other that was available at the time. He himself had been trained from the age of 13 by his father in how this army worked, how this military system worked, how battles should be organized and fought, how he should lead. He also inherited, along with the army and with the training that he himself got from Philip, a group of dozens of senior officers who had received the same training as himself under Philip. That training in how do you command the various units of an army in a plan of battle that takes advantages of the strengths that the Macedonians had, of the weaknesses of the enemy, and of the possibilities of the terrain. Philip had developed a whole system for this, and it was a system that he passed on to his various officers, and that includes, of course, Alexander. Now, Alexander had obviously great charisma himself. He understood his father's military system perfectly, and he had the ability to carry it out and the leadership characteristics to impose himself on what was really a remarkable group of men, Philip's officer corps. But it's also true, of course, that he inherited Philip's mantle. All these extraordinary officers deferred to him because as long as he showed he had the ability to do what was needed, they had little choice but to. But the army had a fanatical loyalty to its creator, Philip, and as a result also to Philip's son and successor. Alexander's leadership was never really challenged, so long as he was able to show that he basically knew what he was doing, and there's no doubt that he did know what he was doing as a military leader. There's not much question. There's a reason to question whether he had anything more going for him than understanding how to be a good military leader. And I myself wonder whether that's really what we want to consider as a standard of greatness today. People have to judge that for themselves.
One of the points you make in the book that people might think about as they are listening to this is the non-military legacy that sometimes is identified, the most visible example today being the cities, from Kandahar in the east to Alexandria in Egypt and so forth, all these cities that were established within the territory that Alexander conquered. And you make the point that leads us to talking about what happens after his death, which is that though so many of these cities are named after him to one degree or another, they aren't necessarily cities that he himself has established.
Exactly. I think that's a crucial point. What makes the Hellenistic civilization what it was is the spread of Greek city planning, Greek-style cities with Greek-speaking populations. It's open to question how many of them actually have any origins in Greece. But certainly they were Greek-speaking and they lived according to the traditional, by that point, classical Greek lifestyle involving going to the gymnasium, going to the theater to watch plays, having collective self-governing systems, and so on. Those cities are overwhelmingly built between 320 and 280 or 270 BCE in that rough 50-year period, which is after the time of Alexander. Alexander began the process. What he really did was to found a dozen or so garrison colonies in what is today Afghanistan, and to give orders that a city be founded in Egypt at Alexandria. But Alexandria was actually built by Alexander's successor, the Egyptian ruler Ptolemy. And it was really Alexander's successors who, over that 50-year period, partly imported probably in excess of 100,000 people from Greek lands into Western Asia and Egypt and settled them in what became Greek cities, and partly also incorporated elements of the native population into these Greek cities and allowed and encouraged them to become Greek by learning the Greek language, taking Greek names, and adapting themselves to the Greek urban lifestyle. And what you get at the end is a civilization in Western Asia and Egypt where there are many, many dozens of Greek cities built on the model of essentially classical Athens, with mostly the rectangular grid system of urban planning that we know from places like Manhattan, for example, in New York, big avenues running parallel to each other, and then smaller cross streets crossing them at a 90-degree angle, roughly, also parallel to each other, with key public spaces sited within that grid. The process of doing that is undertaken essentially by three great successors of Alexander, who took over the bulk of his empire within a few years of his death. Antigonus the One-Eyed, Seleucus the Victorious, and Ptolemy the Savior. These guys like to have picturesque nicknames. But partly that it comes from the fact that they were so impressive and important as foundational figures in what we call the Hellenistic world, that their successors as rulers basically named themselves after these founders. So in Egypt, for example, you have the Macedonian general Ptolemy founding this kingdom and building the city of Alexandria. And then you have 15 other rulers after him, all named Ptolemy, Ptolemy the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth. They all have to be named Ptolemy because Ptolemy is really the extraordinary founding figure who they all hark back to and who gives them their claim to power. And in Western Asia, you have a whole series of kings named Seleucus after the first Seleucus. And likewise, you have a dynasty of kings who use the name Antigonus after the first Antigonus. So they're not men who are particularly famous now, but they are men who had an enormous impact, not only in their own lifetime in being able to do this extraordinary organizing work, and creating this new civilization, but who were also enormously powerful figures in the popular imagination for the next 2 to 3 centuries. Of course, what happened eventually is that the Romans moved in and took over this whole area. It became the Eastern Roman Empire. And then the memory of these Hellenistic rulers kind of faded because of the extraordinary dominance and success of the Romans. And the one figure who sort of maintained his fame was Alexander. And I think that's partly because of the sort of the romance inherent in the fact that Alexander was only in his 20s when he carried out his conquests. And we tend to be very impressed by men who do extraordinary things when they're young and then die young, with a sense of, what would they have done if only they'd lived for another, 30 years? Well, who knows? That's what gives them that sense of romantic appeal. And there's also the reality that, and this is one of these extraordinary things about Alexander, of all sort of known rulers in history, there are very, very few, if any, who paid as much intensely focused attention to their popular image. He was a ruler who believed from the moment he took over as king and began on this campaign of conquest, he wanted everyone to know about it and to see him as a superhuman figure. And he took with him basically propagandists of all sorts, court historians, court poets, court philosophers, court artists, whose job was to present him, Alexander, and his actions as superhuman from the beginning. I think that's possibly one of the things in which he, in fact, was most successful, obviously, because to this day, he's still remembered as this superhuman figure that he presented himself as through his various official court propagandists.
And yet, I can't help but feel after reading your book how much of that relies upon not just the propagandists, but the achievements of people like Antigonid and Ptolemy and Seleucid, because you describe how so much of what he had accomplished was unsustainable, projecting his power all the way to India from a resource base in Macedonia was not right. Something that was going to endure. And yet, and so it was these men who in a sense took what could have been this incredibly impermanent entity, the Alexandrian Empire. And while it doesn't survive intact, it definitely survives in a form that implies that it could have been a little different had he lived, and at the very least endures long enough to cement the achievement of those brief years of conquest.
Yes. It survived, of course, precisely because Alexander's successors were able to import enough Greek manpower, probably well in excess of 100,000 people, brought over from the Greek lands to inhabit new cities in Western Asia, forming in essence a kind of permanent garrison, but also, you know, that Greek urban culture was very appealing in various ways, and a lot of non-Greek people acculturated themselves, that is to say, became Greek, by going to live in these cities, learning the Greek language, taking Greek names, adapting themselves to the culture and the way of life, and essentially becoming indistinguishable from the originally Greek population. Without that, you know, an army of 50,000 men can only be in one place at one time. If you have to keep using it in order to maintain power, you soon use it up. You have to build institutionalized mechanisms of control, and there's no sign that Alexander gave any thought to that because he was still in the act of conquest. But certainly also his successors very quickly took a series of decisions that made the lands that they were going to rule more rational. One of the first things that Seleucus did was to realize that trying to hold on to what is today Pakistan made absolutely no sense. When he was engaged in warfare there with a local Indian ruler, named Chandragupta, who eventually founded quite a big empire in India, the Maurya Empire, Seleucus basically looked to make a deal you can have these lands. Just give me something in exchange for them so that I can pull out with, keeping my image intact. And what Sir Lucas came away with was 500 Indian war elephants, in return for which he ceded basically the entirety of what is today Pakistan, which Alexander had conquered, but which Sir Lucas realized there's no way for us to hold on to this. It's absurdly far away from our home bases. Greeks don't want to live here. Just get out and hold on to the lands that make sense. And the lands that it really made sense to hold on to were Mesopotamia, modern-day Iraq, and then west of that, today, Syria, Palestine, Turkey, and Egypt. The lands, that is to say, that were close enough to the Mediterranean, that Mediterranean peoples, which is what the Greeks were, could effectively occupy and dominate them.
We've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
I'm actually working on a project several hundred years further down the line in the history of the ancient world, in the early stages of Christianity. The rise of Christianity occurred, of course, precisely in the cultural context of the Hellenistic world, when, Jesus' successor, so to speak, Paul, traveled around spreading the good word. He traveled around a Greek-speaking world from one Greek city to another, addressing people in the Greek language about this wonderful new religion. So I've become quite interested in that. And what I'm actually working on is the branch of early Christianity called Gnosticism, the form of Christianity that emphasized revealed knowledge over the Orthodox, or what became called the Orthodox view. That became the mainstream form of Christianity. The church fathers, as they're called, who developed what we call Orthodox Christianity, produced a set of canonical writings that they declare to be the official texts from which one understands what the Christian religion is and is to be understood as. We call it the New Testament. There's actually a whole set of alternative writings produced by Gnostic Christians. It occurred to me that it would be interesting to imagine what the New Testament would look like if the Gnostics had become the dominant movement within Christianity. So I'm putting together what I call the New Testament Gnostic Christian version. And it basically is formatted like the traditional New Testament, with four Gospels and a bunch of letters and Revelation writings. Instead of the ones that everyone is familiar with, they are Gnostic Christian Gospels and letters and Revelation writings. I think Gnosticism is an extraordinary interpretation of Christianity that has a lot to say to the modern world. I'm hoping that people will find it interesting to look at a work that presents a kind of what might have been alternative version of Christianity.
Well, it sounds like a very interesting project.
I like to think so.
Oh, Richard Billows, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much.